Great, Cindy. Thank you so much. That is really a very comprehensive discussion. I'm looking forward to the robust discussion we can have. And so I'll get started and ask you the first question, but I want to just remind all of our callers out there that the objective of our program tonight is to really hear feedback from you, not only from your anecdotal practice experience, but also any research or evidence-based practice items that you want to share. So if you have a question or a comment, please dial star 1 to ask questions and to come into queue. Doug will be able to let you in on the answer line or question line, and then we can have you respond. But I'll go ahead and get the discussion started. And I just wanted to go back to kind of the point that you made, Cindy, about the fact that patients with brain lesions, or rather more spinal cord disease, seem to express less depression. And while you were talking, I was kind of sifting through my own patient cadre and thinking, you know, is this true for my patient cases, you know, generally speaking as well? And it was interesting. When I start thinking of spinal cord patients, I start thinking about our neuromyelitis optica patients. And although it's a different disease entity, you know, they mostly have spinal cord disease, and few have some brain lesions as well. However, you know, that started to resonate, and I think you're right in that I do see more kind of resilience or coping mechanisms coming into play with those patients who have greater spinal cord illness than they do brain. And so I wanted to know, was that also your experience, if you've had experience with NMO patients? And not that I want to direct all of the discussion towards NMO, because it's really a discussion of MS, but I just, of course, when you're thinking spinal cord, you kind of think immediately those patients.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of experience with NMO. We have a handful. But what I was thinking about was more my gentlemen that have primary progressive MS.
Mm.
And I have a couple that have been in clinical trials with me, and they're wheelchair-bound, and they are great. They have the best outlook on life. You know, life is great, couldn't be happier. They just cope so well. I have this one gentleman that we had to bring in, and we had to do another evaluation for electric wheelchair because he wore it out mowing lawns and trimming, and he does his lawn and his mother-in-law's lawn and his mother's lawn, and it's just amazing.
Wow. So very resilient, huh?
Very, yeah. And I don't know if that speaks to the fact that he has mostly spinal cord disease or if it's because he's had MS for a number of years and the resilient spirit and the way that people can adapt.
Sure. And I wanted to ask you, too, as part of your nursing approach with treatment, do you ever find yourself talking about coping mechanisms specifically along with the non-pharmaceutical treatments for patients?
Well, I think that's kind of my forte because I don't prescribe. So when I see my patients, I'm going to talk more about what they can do to add quality to their life as far as making sure that they have good sleep hygiene, mm-hmm. that they're eating a well-balanced diet, deal with some of the other symptom management that maybe I can help them with, constipation, urinary problems. And I do like complementary and alternative medicine, and I'm a big one on yoga for MS and meditation.
Yeah, definitely.
I have lots of handouts and flyers that I give out.
Do you have any of those flyers that you use? Would you recommend, are there any websites that the callers can maybe go to for those, or are they something that you guys developed in your office?
It's not something that we developed. It's stuff that I got put together for a talk that I did on complementary and alternative medicine.
Okay.
But there is an awful lot out on the internet, and the National MS Society has some wonderful pamphlets.
Yeah, they have great literature. I want to give Doug an opportunity to again, give directions. I understand we don't have anybody in queue, and I know you guys don't want to hear Cynthia and I talk all night. So I really am impressing and encouraging you to call in with some of your own questions and comments. But Doug, I'll let you go ahead and give the formal directions.
Thank you, Jen. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, you may press star 1 on your telephone keypad. This will place you in our electronic queue. If you'd like to remove yourself from the queue, you may press star 2. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the star key. One moment while we poll for the questions.
So while we're waiting, I just want to also ask about the immune modulatory connection. This is really kind of the first time I've heard this, and it is compelling, you know, when you were saying that we see decreased levels of anti-inflammatory cytokines when there are with the relapses and the correlation there. And I was just curious, where did you find that information so that we can kind of do some more self-directed study with that?
I should have put a note on the bottom there of where I got that from.
Well, it's, you know, if you don't have it, we can put it on the website later.
Yeah, I think I can find it, though.
Okay.
It was actually an article that Randy Schiffer did.
Oh, okay.
And it was in the International Journal of MS Care.
Okay. So I'm sure we can we can figure that out and have Lenny post it.
And
the other thing, I just wanted to remind the callers that Cynthia put together a really lovely PowerPoint presentation that kind of outlines all of the information that she spoke to this evening, and that is actually available on the website at www.iomsn.org that you can access, or if you have colleagues who weren't able to join the call this evening and they want to listen to the podcast, they can actually go through the PowerPoint as they're hearing the podcast. So, Doug, do we have anybody in queue?
No, we do not, not at this time.
Okay. So, Cynthia, do you want to speak any more to any of your clinical experience, any interesting cases that you had that stuck out and kind of some really maybe positive things that you were able to do in your practice that would be pearls of wisdom for maybe new nurses?
Well, one of the things that we would like to do here at our center would be to have a social worker on site so that we could really have someone that if we did a screening and we got a positive response for depression, we could immediately bring someone in to have that first contact. And then certainly a more intense visit would be set up later on. As far as pearls of wisdom for depression, I have been amazed at the change that I've seen in some of my patients when they've gotten on the right antidepressant. You can see it in their get up and go, even when you're bringing them from the waiting room into your exam room. Their whole demeanor is different.
Mm-hmm.
They have more eye contact and a smile on their face, and they're more engaging. So it can be very
multifactorial. Really multifactorial in
yes.
your approach for treatment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I would be interested in hearing if anybody has any on-site social workers or counselors at their practice.
Yeah, definitely. So we want to put that question out to the audience, if you could call in and let us know. When you have patients coming in, are you screening for depression? Do you have a social worker on hand? How do you guys deal with either acute depression or even just the kind of day-to-day depression that you might see in endogenous MS? One of the things I can speak to is we have a National MS Society, and I know it's different in kind of, you know, I've worked in both in New York and North Carolina and now in Florida, and the chapter that I'm working with now actually has generously given us a social worker one day a week, comes out from the society. She's actually an MSW who works at the chapter but does do counseling free of charge to patients one day a week at our center. Which has been an absolute treasure to have her on site and just to be able to bounce things off. And then we actually just hired an MSW who's actually one of our research coordinators. But she's also been a gem in the sense of she doesn't do counseling. That's not her role in our office. But just being able to kind of bounce some ideas off of her for, you know, when you're diagnosing coping deficits, you know, which is a nursing diagnosis, being able to kind of implement interventions and doing the counseling and education, which I think is so much, regardless of what level of nursing you're practicing at, is so inherent to our role.
Definitely. It's been the practice of our providers here that if a patient, especially if they're newly diagnosed and having trouble coping with their diagnosis or with a lot of symptoms they might be having, it's not uncommon for them to say, you'll be a perfect research patient. Because they get that one-on-one care. I screened someone today for a study we're doing for constipation, and I'm amazed at how these people can like have one or two bowel movements a month and not be concerned.
Goodness.
I know. It's like, and you're not taking anything? And this older woman has had MS for a number of years. She was just kind of down in the dumps and was having a bad day, and I poke my head in the room and I query everybody, are you constipated? And she laughed and thought that was funny. And by the end of the day, after I was done screening her, I made her day. She was smiling and laughing, and I have a new best friend. Because she just is so happy that she never even thought about talking about constipation, and it just perked her up, and now, you know, we're going to be able to help her out. And that works the same way with any symptom management that we help our patients out with, because they may not think to bring it up, and especially with depression.
Right.
Because it does creep up, or it becomes your new normal, and you figure, well, of course I'm depressed. Who wouldn't be?
Right, right. It just kind of comes along with the territory that we assume, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to turn it over. Doug, do we have questions in queue?
Yes, we do. We have our first question comes from the line of Marie Moore from Charlotte, North Carolina. Please proceed with your question. Marie, your line is live.
Hi, Marie. Can you hear us?
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I had it on mute. Sorry. first of all, that was a great presentation. Thank you so much for discussing this issue, which we obviously see all the time. I was just curious about, I realize you're not a prescriber, Cynthia, but I was curious to know if you all are keeping patients on antidepressants long-term or taking them off. You know, we routinely from insurance companies here in North Carolina get a note after about 6 months of treatment that, you know, we should reevaluate patients and consider taking them off. And I think those are from obviously studies with patients who do not have MS, but given the pervasiveness of it, I was just kind of, within the MS population, I was just kind of curious how you guys practice.
Great question.
That is a very good question, and it probably comes from the insurance companies not wanting to pay for it if it's
sure.
not needed. But I think it's important to keep reassessing and see. Sometimes we'll go up on a dose, and try and get like a therapeutic level and get some of their symptoms under control. And then, you know, after 6 months or a year, they'll either start backing down on it, or if we've done combination therapy and have tried two antidepressants, try eliminating one and see how they do. So we do reassess it.
Okay. Thank you.
How about in your practice, Marie, what do you guys do?
We, you know, often we're keeping patients on them, and I don't know if that's right or wrong, but we usually keep them on. We do the BDI FAST score, you know, little scale every time they come in and continually assess for depression, and we are very fortunate to have a full-time social worker who we're also able to work with a lot, but we're keeping them on them, and I think it's probably just because our kind of underlying theory is that, again, it occurs within 50% of the population, and it's such a pervasive issue. So, by and large, yeah. Obviously, we try to minimize medicines all the time, you know,
sure,
when
sure.
feasible, but that's when I think we usually allow patients to stay on.
I don't think there's any right or wrong, and based on the evidence, actually, that Cynthia was talking about, you know, is if we're treating with SSRIs, are we actually helping the disease process? It's compelling, and I'm wondering if maybe we should be responding to the insurance companies with some data to justify our practice, because, you know, that was really kind of the first time I was hearing about, you know, the levels of the interferons and the cytokines and chemokines being affected by some of the medication. And I think, to me, that obviously, as Cynthia said, this is an area that's ripe for research, but it's compelling.
Agreed.
So thanks so much for your call, Marie.
Yes, thank you.
Do we have any other questions?
Yes, we have one other one in queue. Our next one comes from the line of Vanessa Zimmerman from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Please proceed with your question.
Yeah, yes. I actually work at the University of Pennsylvania, also as a research coordinator, and we don't have a social worker at our site, and we definitely, as the nurses, have identified that as a strong need that we have. So I'm glad to hear that others are having the same problem. But Cynthia, I was going to ask you a question. I wrote down during your presentation leads to neurological damage, and then I wrote, therefore, you said it's very important to screen. If you could just go over that piece again, did you say that people who have depression that is untreated, that can lead to further neurological damage versus if it is treated?
Well, based on the study that they did looking at the pro-inflammatory cytokines, it could.
Okay.
It's an interesting concept. I mean, in the sense that this is really the when we talked about this, Cynthia and I and Lori in kind of our dress rehearsal, this is the first time that we had really heard about this. And I think those nurses who are, you know, out there who are specifically in research, this would be a great thing to take back to some of the physicians in the office and see if we couldn't do investigator-initiated trials, you know, just to even get some pilot data. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Vanessa.
Well, I think that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, it certainly is an area that needs a lot more research in, but it was, I mean, could you imagine if, you know, we could treat MS with an antidepressant and modify their disease? That'd be pretty cool.
That and a little vitamin D will be good to go.
Yeah, and then we're good to go, right? Yeah, who needs a shot?
Right. Vanessa, I wanted to ask you before you jump off, is since you guys don't have a social worker in your practice, and Dottie's there with you, Dottie Hull, right?
Yes.
Are you guys doing most of the counseling then for patients, or who in the office is doing that when it's necessary?
Well, yeah, it's between the nurses and the physicians, but, I mean, we definitely feel there's a lot that goes undone because we don't have that person, that social worker there.
Yeah, it's definitely a positive and an essential need because, you know, we can't do it all. But
right.
But thanks for sharing that information.
All right. Thank you very much. It was a great conference.
Thank you. We have one more in queue, Doug.
Yes, we do. Our next one comes from the line of Marie Namy from Cleveland, Ohio. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, everyone.
Marie, are you calling from Amsterdam?
No, I am going tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking that's a long-distance call.
Right.
You win.
And I don't know what time it is there. But thanks, Cindy. That was great. A really good comprehensive overview. I appreciate
Thank you.
Taking the time to do this for IOMSN and everyone else. But it struck me as you were talking, because we do have both a social work and health psychologist available at our MS center, the difficulty is getting patients to agree to see them. You know, people will come in no matter what for their medical follow-ups, and they may not have as much physical disability, but they have this depression that you were talking about, lack of motivation, and, you know, they'll ask us 1,000 questions about MS, and we're talking with them and recognizing that they have mood disorders and say, you know, what can really help you is talking with a psychologist. And they're like, no, I don't need a psychologist, you know. And I find that is a difficult situation with many of my patients. And we sometimes have to make a deal with them. We will start some antidepressant with the caveat that you have to make an appointment and see the psychologist. It has to go hand in hand.
That's interesting.
I mean, what's your thought on something like that?
I don't think we've ever actually done that.
Mm-hmm.
Patients definitely lack insight.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of their reluctance to see, even to admit they have depression or to seek someone formally to diagnose it and treat it is the stigma that still exists with mental illness.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, I say, you know, we really recognize that people with MS have problems, concerns about their mood for one reason or another. And that's why we've hired a psychologist specifically to work with our patients, you know, and make it more of a general statement and include everyone so that they don't feel so you know, isolated or, you know, focused on. But it's hard sometimes.
So you just make it your practice that everyone meets with them?
Not always. We try to negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd be willing, because people want a quick fix. You
yeah,
know, that sort of
absolutely.
Thing, how they go. So we say, you know, I'd be happy to start you on. I don't want to withhold any treatment from you. This is an issue. But the best intervention is if you, you know, start with both medicine and psychologist. And people are amazed. You know, it's like when you tell people, well, exercise can be helpful, and then they don't do it. And then they start exercising and say, gosh, that was really helpful. Why did anybody ever tell me that?
Yeah.
The same kind of situation.
And I think they just need to try it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's such a good idea to make, like, this little pact with
mm-hmm.
them. I recently, not recently, probably a year ago, started seeing a social worker to help out with some family problems, and my husband goes.
Uh-huh.
And he says he doesn't really see any value in it anymore. Should we keep going? And I said, well, you can stop, but I'm going. Because
yeah.
it's just nice to talk to somebody, because after it's been going on for a year and nothing's changed, it's nice. You don't want to burden family or friends, you know, with it, because it's just nice to talk to somebody who isn't family or friends.
Right. I think, though, sometimes our patients just have such a tremendous amount of burden of disease in many ways that it's just so hard for them to move past it. You know, I think, I mean, kudos to you for saying this is what we got to do, you know, and moving forward with it. And then you find a good outcome. But sometimes I think it's just so hard for our patients to make that move.
Thanks, Marie. I wanted to ask you, too, before you jump off while I was listening to you guys talk, I was thinking, you know, how many times do we end up finding depression as a kind of a backdoor diagnosis, in the sense that I was thinking today I had a patient in my office who was complaining of decreased libido. And that was the kind of chief complaint. But when we really started to excavate that a little bit, what we really found is that there's some significant underlying depression.
Yeah.
You know, and same with when patients come in, they're complaining of pain or cognitive issues. I think what you eventually end up kind of excavating and seems to usually underlie, if not accentuate, is that they have this underlying untreated depression, but they may not have identified it or perhaps are in denial about it because of the mental health stigma that still exists.
Right. And people are even more accepting of having a cognitive problem. You know, they'll come in and say, well, my thinking isn't clear, I'm having this problem. And as you say, it's more of an underlying anxiety or depression. It's just an interesting phenomenon that we as human beings have, you know.
Right, right.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Marie, for calling in.
Mm-hmm.
Safe travels tomorrow.
Thank you.
So I wanted to open up the lines to anyone else on the call if they want to share some of their practical experience on any of the points that we've been discussing thus far. And, Doug, do you want to just review the directions once again, just to remind our callers?
Certainly. It is *1 to ask a question, and we do have somebody else in queue.
Oh, great.
Our next question comes from the line of Carol Saunders from Oceanside, California. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, everybody.
Hi,
there's just
Carol.
One thing that I wanted to mention, and that is the very frustrating thing that happens when you can't get a person in to see a psychiatrist and they really need to see them, whether it is because their insurance won't pay, which is very often the case, and if you do not have a social worker and you do not have a psychologist on staff, how do you get them in? And then the good psychiatrists are so doggone busy that they don't want to take new patients too. And that's just another real problem when you have somebody that needs help.
Yeah, I hear your frustration. And that's a common thing that we have too. We have a couple providers that we like to refer our patients to because they're used to our MS patients. And that's I feel, is key for anything, whether it's physical therapy, occupational therapy. They kind of need to know MS. But if they don't have good coverage or they can't get in to be seen, it can be very frustrating.
It certainly can be. And if, you know, you do have your favorites, and they're the ones that you would like to refer to. And if the insurance won't allow you to do that, it's terribly frustrating for you as you're trying to work with the patient. Another thing that I think is very important that we haven't mentioned, and that is when a person is newly diagnosed with MS, if you can work some with them and make sure that they understand MS and understand what's going on, perhaps as a part of a support group for newly diagnosed patients, something like that. You can get their head on straight so that maybe they're not going to have some of the depressant problems that they would have otherwise.
Oh, absolutely.
I think, Carol, that's a great point. And I think, the best defense for depression is a great offense. And, kind of heading things off before they start with patients is absolutely a great, I think, nursing skill, and one that, if we can get patients treated earlier, just like with the disease-modifying therapy, and treat them with non-pharmaceutical interventions early on, we might be able to mitigate to the extent that we're having to wrestle with insurance companies to get them to reimburse patients for medications later on.
And fortunately, that's one thing that nurses can do, can work with groups of patients early on and help them understand. And I think that and form relationships with them that are lasting. When you don't have the privilege of having a psychologist on staff or a social worker.
Yeah, and it certainly in your breadth of experience as far as the many, many years that you worked. I'm sure you can speak to that, and the fact that sometimes the nurse is the most consistent person that they're seeing in the office.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And thank you very much, Cindy. That was a nice talk.
Oh, thank you. So good to hear your voice, Carol.
It's good to talk with all of you.
So we'll go ahead and, is there any other callers, Doug?
Yes, we do. We do have one more in queue.
Great.
Our next comes from the line of Dorothy Fole from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Please proceed with your question.
Hi.
Hi, Dottie.
I'm glad you can hear me because I had to switch to my cell phone, and I don't know how to put it off mute if I had been on mute. But first of all, Cynthia, thank you. I was really so impressed by the scope of your talk and how you covered all the different aspects of the topic. I'm just looking forward to listening to the podcast so that anything I missed I'll be able to go over again. But when people were calling, it just strikes me the strength of relationships, particularly as Carol had mentioned, the nurses and the ability to use both the team approach and interdisciplinary approach, but also the relationships. And the whole talk now I find moving in the direction of advocacy and public policy, which is another way of looking at it, because I know, and Vanessa was on the phone earlier about some of the things that we would love to have but don't in our center, where we have to rely on community organizations and trying to find resources for our patients that even folks who are well insured or have the money to pay for care, there's just not a lot of emotional health and support available or emotional or support for mental health services. So it's really a very difficult situation that I think, and when Marie was on the line, I was thinking of our advocacy committees and the work that she's done with public policy, and that sometimes it's at the one-on-one level with the patient, but sometimes it has to go beyond that to look at the bigger picture. So I just found this whole discussion to be really, really important. But I think what I haven't heard yet is the importance of peer support. And because I don't have a social worker and sometimes resources are so thin, I've developed my own little network to help me work with patients through either the community organizations and their support groups, or even well-grounded individuals who are willing to talk with someone when there's a problem. And I'm just wondering, Cindy, do you use any kind of peer support in your practice?
Not officially, no. But we do recommend that patients go to support groups through the MS Society. But nothing like that. That just sounds wonderful.
That's a great point, Patty. And I was thinking, too, when you said peer, I was thinking, you know, patient to patient. And I know there's a couple of programs out there for patients. You know, and what I find in my practice, I actually have a few physicians and other nurses who actually have MS, who've been wonderful.
Exactly.
You know, if we have a support group that we've started and they are comfortable to talk to other patients or, you know, just any patient, regardless of what their career choice was, if they feel comfortable that they have a good handle on managing their chronic illness and have a sense of, you know, the chronicity over time is that they don't have to be chronically ill because they have a chronic illness, and feel comfortable speaking to a group of their peers in a way that's very supportive and also very constructive, you know.
Well, another thing that I was thinking of that we haven't really talked about are the legal aspects, because when we're screening, if we uncover an issue, then we need to deal with that. So, you know, we can't just hand out questionnaires and then, well, that's nice and nobody looks at it.
Right.
So that's always a worry of mine, particularly with like some of the adjunct studies where they're doing some sort of an assessment, but then is anyone following through with the clinicians with that?
That's a great point, Dottie.
Yeah. We have a screening tool that we just started using, and it was more to help us with identifying patients for research. And it's just a symptom management sheet, one sheet that they fill out, and have they been having troubles, is it better, same, you know. And then once the provider looks at it, then it gets sent up to the secretary, and then it's my job to go through and make sure that anything on there that was identified as a problem was addressed. And if it wasn't, then I send out a task or a note saying, what did you think about this?
Mm-hmm.
Just for that reason alone,
mm-hmm.
so nothing falls through the cracks. Because, you know, there's been times when it's been handed to the provider and they get going on something else and maybe forget to address each issue there.
Sure. I know my patients are too smart now to tell me life isn't worth living at 4:45 on Friday, because our place is pretty aggressive if we call in concern, particularly for the person harming themselves. They'll wind up spending the weekend under lock and key. And it actually happened one time where my nurse practitioner agreed with me what the lady was saying was worrisome. And on Monday morning, she called and she said, I will never tell you what it's worth living. But it's a concern. We've had suicides.
Yeah.
But excellent, excellent program, Cynthia, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in, Dottie. Well, Cynthia, I want to give you the last, we have just a couple minutes left before we wrap up, so I just want to give you an opportunity to say the last summarizing words, if you like, before I close the program.
Well, I just think what I would like to stress is that we make sure that we don't forget our patients and their emotional state, and that we take the time to ask the hard questions and to follow through on them and to make sure that they're getting the care that they deserve and need. I was amazed at the high percentage of patients that aren't treated, and maybe we need to push a little, but we need to make sure that they're taken care of.
Great. Thank you. On behalf of the IOMSN Town Hall Discussions, I'd like to thank Cynthia Irish again for your presentation and your time and effort and energy developing this talk. And thank you again to Biogen IDEC for supporting these programs through their unrestricted educational grant. Remember to visit the IOMSN website for a summary and podcast of tonight's program at www.iomsn.org. Also, we ask that you complete the post-town hall discussion survey so that we may continue to improve our programming to better suit your needs. Also, just a reminder, we hope you join us next month when Willie Watley will be presenting advocacy in MS on Tuesday, November 15th. And also, just as a reminder again, to let you know that there are two additional programs this year for the regional programs to get people geared up and ready for the IOMSN, the
MS certification exam. They're also great just refresher courses. The next one is November 19th in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and the last one of the year will be December 10th, 2011 in Oakland, California. So thank you again for joining us this evening. This concludes tonight's program, and we bid you good night.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude tonight's teleconference. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your lines at this time and have a wonderful day.